Looking at 1 Samuel for the past couple months. In the last couple weeks, we've been looking at Saul as the king, the first king of Israel. And we've mentioned numerous times that the book of 1 Samuel is that transition from the judges to the kings. And so Saul is the first of those kings that the people wanted. The people said, we want a king because we want to be like all the nations around us. But we know from even the book of Judges, from Gideon and such, that God was considered to be the king. And he was known to be the king. And so when the people chose to ask for a king, they were choosing to reject the reign of God over the nation. And so, again, the challenge to us individually in that light. So as we've considered Saul, and we considered his coronation and the choosing of him and his coronation, last week we considered and we saw how quickly his kingship, if you would, his reign was rejected. And so last week we looked at the rejection of Saul. But in that context, if you would, there is much more going on in that. And that is that what's getting ready to happen is there's getting ready to be this battle. And this battle is going to be caused by Jonathan going and attacking the Philistines. And it's going to continue on as we move into this. And so as we look at this passage, one of the things we're going to see is Saul and his character flaw. Remember how we talked in the beginning? There was a lot of positive things about Saul that we saw, humility potentially, and that kind of stuff. But as we're tested, as we're put into that cauldron, if you would, kind of like the testimonies this morning, you know, as far as when things are boiling up around us, what happens is those flaws in our characters are what's seen. So as times get tough, if you got to struggle with anger, what begins to be revealed? Anger. And so that's why I joked even about, you know, in testimony time, not really a joke, but for real, if I hadn't had a good testimony or a good quiet time on Friday, I wonder, you know, how I would have reacted to some of the things that went on Friday. I just know I can become agitated very quickly. And so, and I know there were times I was agitated on Friday, but I was able to go back and rejoice in the Lord and keep moving forward. And I wondered if I didn't spend time in God's Word, where would I have gone on those moments of agitation? And so the same thing we're going to see, though, for Saul. Saul, as we saw last week, was rejected because of his disobedience to God. His disobedience to God was, though, a direct result of what? Anybody remember? His disbelief. He didn't believe that Samuel would come. He didn't believe that God would do what God said he would do. And so he offered up the sacrifice and didn't wait. But that was all rolled together with this character flaw that Saul seems to have, and it's a lack of self-control. And when we see someone who struggles with a lack of self-control, many times it's cloaked in impetuousness. Do you ever see people who really are very impetuous? They make rash decisions and they do things, or impatience. You know, you start to become agitated because you're being very what? Impatient with people or whatever. Sometimes that lack of self-control, we see it in a matter of addictions and stuff like that. For Saul, we're going to see this side of impetuousness, though, and impatience that's going to begin to display it in his life. And so if you're not there already, you can turn to 1 Samuel chapter 13, and we're going to pick it up with what's going on now with Jonathan's drama, as I put it. The drama that really Jonathan's going to cause, but again, who's sovereign? God is, okay? So though it's a drama, if you would, that has been caused by Jonathan, God still is sovereign over all, and he uses these things in the tapestry of life to bring about his ways and his will. So we're here in 1 Samuel 13, and I want to begin reading in verse 16. 1 Samuel chapter 13, beginning verse 16, where we read, Saul, Jonathan his son, and the people present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Okay? So this brings us our scenario, if you would, because again, remember, Jonathan provocation. The Philistines, they brought together an army, and they're coming up against Israel, okay? So Saul, Jonathan, his son, and the people present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Then raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned onto the road of Ophrah to the land of Shual. Another company turned to the road of Beth-horon, and another company turned to the road of the border that overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. Now, there was no blacksmith to be found throughout the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for sharpening was a pim for the plowshares and mattocks and forks and axes and to set the points of the goads. So it came about on the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. The first thing we want to look at here in this is the formidableness of the Philistines. The formidableness of the Philistines. We see this deployment of their troops. Before we begin to look at that real quick, I want you to stop for a moment and I want you to step back, okay? And you should ask yourself, wow, this is something. This formidableness of the Philistines and what all they're going to inflict here upon the Israelites. How did they come to be so strong? Do you remember way back in the beginning of the book of 1 Samuel? We're not very many chapters removed from this, okay? When God brought a judgment against Eli and his sons, do you remember? And at that moment, we were told that the Philistines were doing something. Do you remember what they were doing? They were gathering together to attack the Israelites. Apparently, the Israelites were the stronger back in the beginning of the book of 1 Samuel. And Philistines were seeking to take a little of the sting out of them, but they wanted the reign. They wanted to be the most powerful. And so they came against them. Well, then the children of Israel, they brought the Ark of the Covenant, like the lucky rabbit's foot, into the camp, right? And all the Israelites did what? They roared and they shouted. And we're told that the earth quaked. Remember that for later, okay? And the earth quaked and shook. And the Philistines were what? They were afraid, because nothing like this has ever happened before, where they brought the gods into the camp. I mean, woe unto us Philistines. Act like men. Fight like men. Don't give up. Don't quit, right? Remember all that? Okay. Well, now all of a sudden, here we are, and we just talked about Israel. And Israel has what? No swords. They don't even have a blacksmith amongst them. How quickly times have changed. How quickly Israel had given up their superiority to the Philistines. And again, when we take the spiritual analogy here, okay, which I'm not going to carry all the way through, but I want to bring to you right now so you can try to hopefully carry some of this through. Did God give you a victory when you came to Jesus Christ as your Savior? What did he give you a victory over? Some of it? Are you sure? Why is it then that it seems like sin so many times has the upper hand on us? It shouldn't, should it? But when it gets the upper hand, it's because what? We have gradually allowed it to regain that upper hand. Does that make sense? And so take that analogy and just think of that as we come through this. Because I don't want to focus on that side of it. I want to focus more on Saul and what's happening here. But we have the deployment of their troops, this formidableness of the Philistines. They're breaking their company their group into three companies, okay? And they're going out. Now, does anybody remember how much they have? They have a bunch, okay? We go back up into chapter 13 a little further, okay? Say again. Back up in verse 5, okay? They have 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as a sand which is on the seashore in multitude. Okay? So let's say they broke that up into what? Three equal groups, right? You got 10,000 chariots in each of these three companies. You got 2,000 horsemen, and you only got a third of the sand that's on the seashore in each of it. That's still a whole lot of sand, ain't it? Everywhere you look, there's what? Philistines. And it's not just infantry. You got the cavalry. It's not just the cavalry, but you got the tanks, which were the chariots at the time. Okay? I mean, this is just a massive army. And so, and not only with the deployment of the troops, but we see this disarmament of the Philistines. Now, there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. And again, I wonder, how did they go about getting rid of all those blacksmiths in the land? They had to have taken the upper hand so much that they rid of themselves totally of a blacksmiths. And they said, from now on, if you want to sharpen your axes or your goads or whatever, you've got to come to us. Now, look what's really interesting here. See, in New King James, as I read that, you see that there was a charge, right? And it says, verse 21, and the charge for sharpening was a pim for the plowshares and to set the points of the goads. I know there are times when I sound like I'm challenging things because I say this isn't what it says. But this isn't what it says in Hebrew, okay? Let me show you what it says, okay? We have the charge for sharpening was a pim, okay? The word petzar, and you can go check me out, okay, if you were in the Bible Institute class, right? I've shown you all these tools on eSword and stuff like that. You can go check me out on this and make sure that I'm right, okay? I've taught those how to do word studies, and so you can go check out every one of the places that this word is being used, okay, and see if I'm right on this one, okay? Anyways, but the word is used for here for charge is the word, Hebrew word, petzar. It means to blunt or to dull. To blunt or to dull. It doesn't mean to charge. The word pim is from peh, which means mouth or edge. Literally, it wasn't they charged the pim. It means that when they took them to the Philistines, they did what? They blunted the edge. They blunted the edge of the pickaxe. They blunted the edge of that. You say, why would they do that? Because a sharp axe can still do what? Can kill you. Okay? And so a blunt axe is kind of hard to work with. If you are trying to be the taskmasters over these other people, do you want them to have sharp tools? No. So you get rid of the blacksmiths in the land. You make them come to you to have their tools sharpened. And you tell the blacksmiths, whenever the Hebrews come in and you're sharpening their tools, make sure that when you're done, you do what? You blunt the end. This is where Israel's at with the Philistines right now. This formidableness of the Philistines. I mean, they're coming in with all these chariots, all these horses, and all these infantry. And what does Israel have? They have dull axes, dull goads, two swords. So you're Israel. You're Saul. Again, remember this is what I was talking about last week. I mean, I understand Saul. I understand the rashness of the decisions. I'm not saying he's right. I understand it because I'm a man too. And there are times that I what? I can be impetuous because of a lack of self-control. Does it make sense? So I'm not picking on Saul from somebody in the ivory tower saying, oh, Paul, Saul, I can't believe Saul did this kind of stuff. It's like, ooh, I don't like when I see the mirror of God's word pointing right back at me. Does it make sense? So this is not to pick on any of you. This is not to pick on Saul. This is a passage I'd rather just slide on past, and we don't have to preach on this thing because it's too close to home, you know? And so I understand Saul. I mean, the odds were so far against him. I mean, what was he going to do? Well, then we have this foray of Jonathan. Jonathan doesn't help matters much, you know? He's kind of probably, Saul's kind of probably, you know, gathering the troops, but the troops are fleeing from him. He just lost. He's being told that he's being rejected as the king. All these things are going on. He's probably trying to figure out what's he going to do, right? And then the next thing he knows, the earth is shaking, you know, and something's happening going on. And we'll talk about that perspective in a moment. But something's going on. Well, what happened? Jonathan's foray. Jonathan's not done with this drama. Remember, Jonathan's the guy who started all this. You know, Jonathan's young. You know, he's bold. And he's decided that he's going to go in and he's going to attack the Philistines, you know. And so let's read what it says here beginning in verse 1, chapter 14. It says, now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. 600 men against all these others, you know? But again, as we said at the end of last week, right? Gideon only had what? 300. So he ought to feel pretty good. He's got double what Gideon had. But I don't think any of us would have sat there thinking to ourselves, wow, I got double what Gideon has against this whole horde. And so he's got 600 men. Verse 3, Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. The name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sinnah. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward toward Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised, that it may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains Yahweh from saving by many or by few." And to that we should say, amen, huh? So his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Go then. Here I am with you, according to your heart." That guy has more faith than Jonathan. I mean, think about it. I mean, Jonathan's had faith, I think, something. He's either got bravado or great faith, right? And so he's going to go and he's going to attack the Philistines. And we've already said what the garrison looks like, right? So one guy against all those, okay? So he's just going to go. But this armor bearer, does he have a sword? No, he's got his shield. He's got Jonathan's shield. And it's his job to protect Jonathan from being hit. And so what a commitment to his master. Do all that's in your heart. You know, if we're going to go and die, we're going to what? Go and die. Then Jonathan said, "Very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, wait until we come down to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them." Notice he doesn't say what? Then we'll turn around and flee. Okay? It says, "But if they say to us, come up to us, then we will go up, for Yahweh has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us." Stop for a moment. I want you to think about that. I'm a little bit older now. I'm not in my young 20s. I'm not as bravado. I was going to say foolhardy, but we'll say bravado and you know, all that kind of stuff. Now in my older age, I sit there and I think to myself, okay, if there was these two Hebrews coming up acting foolish and bravado like that, and you were the Philistines, what would you say? Come on up here. You wouldn't say, "Hey, stay down there, we'll come to you." Why would you go down to the rocks? You're going to say what? "Come on up here and let's teach you a lesson." Just exactly what we're going to see the Philistines say. So he says, so if they say to us, "Come on up," we'll know that Yahweh has what? Delivered them into our hands. Do you think Jonathan goes into this knowing and planning and preparing for and ready for this battle? I think so. This is what he wants. This is exactly. And so whether God has worked this within him, whether God is blessing in spite of it, I can't answer that. All I know is that what the Bible teaches and that it was Jonathan's idea to go, and he's trusting wholeheartedly that God is going to work within this moment, okay? So verse 12, the men of the garrison called to Jonathan, his armor bearer, and said, "Come up to us, and we will show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for Yahweh has delivered them into the hand of Israel." And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees, okay, not quite in the what? The attack posture, okay? Where's his sword at? It's either strapped to his side or it's in his hand, which is what? He's climbing. Or his armor bearer has it. No, I don't think so. Jonathan has a sword. The armor bearer is trying to deal, climb up with his hands and knees while he's holding Jonathan's shield, okay? And so they're climbing up, hands and knees after him, and they fell, and yeah, he climbed up before after them. At the end of verse 13, and they fell before Jonathan, and as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter with Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about a half an acre of land. Literally, that half acre of land, this is just for fun, literally in the Hebrews, it's a half a furrow of a yoke of cattle of a field. That's what an acre is. I said to Marcia, I said, "Do you know what an acre is, really?" She said, "She said, I think it's what a yoke of cattle can plow in a day." I thought, "How did you learn that?" She's from the country. Anyways, I'm from the city. I had no clue. I thought, that's exactly what it is. It's amazing. Anyways, and so literally in the Hebrew, that's what it says. It doesn't say half an acre. It says the whole thing about the furrow and half a furrow and stuff like that. Anyway, so there's all those words just to mean what we understand as a half an acre. He killed 20 guys in a half an acre. Is this an amazing thing? I mean, think about it. You got one guy in his armor bearer who probably is a little bit younger, same age or younger than Jonathan. So not very experienced soldiers here. And they're going to come up to these experienced soldiers in a half an acre. That's my yard. I've got about a half an acre. So the other day I was standing out there and I was looking at that. You know, and I think we were talking. You've got 20 experienced soldiers. If this happened in real life, you swore this was Hollywood. You know, and everywhere he goes, the sword's killing somebody. You know? I mean, because you know these guys are coming after him, right? They're not all standing there saying, okay, it's your turn. Okay, you're next. I'd hate to be number 20. I don't think so. I mean, this young guy's just killed 19 of our best guys. I don't think, you know. So you know they're attacking him all one shot, and they wipe him out. They wipe him out. Well, that's Jonathan's perspective. This is what he sees. Let's just continue on here. Verse 15, and there was a trembling in the camp in the field and among the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled. The garrison and the raiders also trembled. And the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away. And they went here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, now call the roll and see who has gone from us. And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, lo, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. So we got now the Philistines' perspective. The Philistines, they're mounting up, ready to just annihilate Israel. They're ready just to squash them. We got to put an end to this. This is nuts. I mean, who are these peons to come and mess with us like this? Again, it was just what? Jonathan. Remember? Jonathan was the one who provoked, right? Nobody else really gets involved in this. So they're coming up against because we're going to squash these guys. And Jonathan is the one, again, that God raises up, I believe, to go and begin the provocation again, to get the thing stirred up some more, right? And so he goes up with his armor bearer. And so think about it from the Philistines' perspective. Here you are, this big, mighty army, right? And all of a sudden, you hear this great commotion over in this one little section of the camp. Okay? And guys start running in to this section, right? And what do they see? They see mayhem happening. Again, I don't know how fast all this thing is going on, but people are dying everywhere. And I got the feeling it looks a lot like Gideon. Because when the 300 men who followed Gideon, they smashed the pitchers, and they held up the torch, and they said, the sword for the Lord and for Gideon. How did all the Canaanites die? They killed each other. They started to attack each other. And that's what starts to happen in the Philistine camp. There's this confusion that all starts going in. They don't have an idea who's fighting who, what's going on. And all of a sudden, they start fighting each other. And there's this rumble. There's this trembling. The word there, the first trembling, is anxiety in the camp. There's an anxiety that's going, this trembling, this fear that's going throughout the camp. I think this is a God moment. When God is kind of working in the enemy, and he's, again, like when David, or when God says to David, when you hear the sound of the troops moving through the tops of the trees, then you attack, you know? Or the time when with Hezekiah and Sennacherib was coming against him, and he gets wind that there's the Egyptians are coming up against, and he runs. God is able to do and put thoughts as well in brains and cause people to think things, and it's an amazing thing. And so there's this trembling going on in the camp, right? And then a different word is used: the earth quaked. Now, we're not told over on the Israel side that it quaked. We're just told that Israel kind of felt a tremor, and they looked over to see what was going on. There was all this stuff going on. I think there was a very localized earthquake at that moment. That when Jonathan did what God had called him to do, again, I'm extracting here, okay? I mean, I know it doesn't say it specifically, but Jonathan, by faith, went to move a mountain. He had faith the size of a mustard seed. Sometimes when we see people have faith like this, we say they're what? Foolhardy. We say, that can't be of God. And all I know is he went to do, and he had this faith in God. He didn't say, we can do this. He said, we'll know that God, Yahweh, has handed them into us, right? And so he's following the plan of God, the will of God, whatever, in his life, and he gets up there. And now who's really is the battle? It's God's battle. Isn't this just like what David says when he goes, we'll see this in a few weeks, when he goes up before Goliath? You come to me with a sword and a spear, but I come to you in the name of Yahweh. I mean, the battle's his. This is his battle. It's not mine. You got it all wrong. You're looking at me, this little bitty dog, and you're this big old pickle. Anyways, sorry, that's VeggieTales. So, but I know the battle belongs to God. So Jonathan comes up, and there's all this trembling, this anxiety and trembling going on in Philistines, and then God, I think, just takes the mountain and does, just kind of shakes it a little bit more. So you're a Philistine, and you run upon the scene, and there's all this commotion going on, and Philistine, your soldiers are dying left and right all over the place. You don't see any Israelites except for one little guy and his armor bearer, right? And all of a sudden, the earth beneath you starts to tremble. What do you think? Let's get out of here. Woe unto us. Woe unto us. They get it. They understand what's going on here, and that, I mean, that God is fighting for the Israelites here, okay? Well, then we have the Hebrews' perspective, right? They're looking from the distance, and they're saying, hey, what's going on over there in the Philistine camp? Look, I mean, everybody's melting away. I mean, what's going on? There's all this commotion going on, you know, this little tremor, right? And so they say, take a roll. I wonder why that was the first thing that came to his mind. Take a roll. Find if somebody's missing. Did he instantly think that maybe Jonathan might have done this? Had Jonathan kind of slipped it at some point saying, boy, somebody just needs to do this. And so his dad was against it, and so he just went and did it on his own anyway. I don't know. I'm reading into it. But there's got to be a reason that Saul's first reaction was to take a roll, to find out, you know, why. Why? Who's missing? So they find out that Jonathan, an armor bearer, is missing, right? And so the next thing that happens, okay, it said, verse 18, Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. For at that time, the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened, while Saul talked to the priest, that noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to battle, and indeed every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews, who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines had fled, they also followed hard after them in battle. So Yahweh saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth-Aven. So the Hebrews' perspective. What do they see? They see this melting away. They see this thing going on. So Saul, for some reason, says, take a roll. He finds out that Jonathan and armor-bearer are gone, right? And so we're going to come back to this next section in a moment of Saul's foolishness. But suffice it for this moment, Saul, the first thing he does next after the roll is he calls for what? The ark. Okay? He calls for the priest. He calls for the ark. Why does he do that? Is it because he wants the ark to go with him? What's the priest doing? Remember, because he says to him something. He's asking God. He's going to try to discern the will of God, right? Because how do I know that? Because while the priest is doing that, the noise increases, and Saul, with his impetuousness, his lack of self-control, says what? Forget it. We're doing what I want to do anyway. Just withdraw your hand. That's all he's saying is stop doing what you're doing. We're going. Okay? And so here he is, there, if you would, seeking God's face. But he doesn't have time to wait for the answer. Isn't that what just happened last week when he was rejected? You know, he was supposed to sit there and wait for Samuel to come. But Samuel didn't come, and there was a debate afterwards when we were talking about, but Samuel was late, but he wasn't late. Remember, it was Saul who said, you didn't come at the appointed time. The minute Saul gives the sacrifice, what happens? Samuel walks into camp. So apparently, Saul didn't wait till the end of the day. Saul didn't wait for the day. He got impatient, self-control, and couldn't wait any longer and felt he had to take things into his own hands. The same thing's happening right here. And so we have this final perspective, though, in the very end. Just a quick statement, just a very quick statement, just kind of made. Verse 23. So who saved Israel? Yahweh. So Yahweh saved Israel that day. It's just a byline. It's just kind of a side note. Just kind of footnote. Just so you know, it was Yahweh. Big footnote. Again, it's always God who saves. It's not by the power of your chariots. It's not by the power of your horses. It's not by the power or the strength of your arms. It's Yahweh. It's God. It's Jesus who saves. All they have is a bunch of dull blades. I mean, how much more? Again, isn't this the message that God was showing them over and over and over again through the book of Judges? It's not your military prowess. And that's what he tells the king. Remember in Deuteronomy 17 as we went through in Sunday school. The king's not supposed to multiply chariots, not supposed to multiply horses, nor wives or money. But he's not supposed to do those things because you're not supposed to be trusting in your military prowess. You're supposed to be trusting in the deliverance of God. I mean, when you consider... And I don't want to, it's a side thing, the 6-day war, or some say 7-day war, for Israel with the Arabs. It's amazing to see what God did, but how man likes to try to look at what Israel did to defend itself at that time. God gave them the wisdom to be able to do so many things. It was amazing. It's another moment. You can get a video. It's down at the library. It's awesome. Don't just listen to it from the world's perspective, but as you watch it, think about God. And how God is interacting. It's really fun stuff. Anyways, but God is the one who gives the victory. Yeah, all they have is a bunch of dull pitchforks. And so, yeah, it's kind of fun to think about. I mean, if you think about that battle, I mean, how many chariots and how many horsemen and how many infantry there are against these farmers coming out with dull pitchforks. Anyways, and the dull pitchforks win, you know. It's just an amazing thing. God's perspective. Well, yeah, the four-year Jonathan, but in the end, you've got this foolishness of Saul, and which starts off with this that we can start to see when he talks to the priest and says, remove your hand. I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. And so, but he continues it now. He thinks this is all about him. Now, I mean, again, I don't mean to make it sound like it's just a byline that God gave the victory, but Saul at this moment must be thinking what? He's it. I mean, he is George S. Patton. He is leading the victory march through Europe, you know, and nobody can stand before him. And I'm not picking on Patton, but that's the mindset. I mean, you know, when Patton hit, and there was a woman years ago, Fran Plennert, that we knew. She's passed on now, but she served with Patton. She was a nurse, and she was in that train, and she just talked about the power of him as a leader. And what they were able to do. Well, Saul isn't that at all. He is not that at all, but he must have thought he was, you know? And he must have thought this victory was from his prowessness or something. I don't know. I mean, clearly one guy goes into an enemy camp, right, and starts this whole process, and then you got the vagabonds coming out of the mountains with their pitchforks, and you're routing the Philistines, and you think this is you? Well, he then goes on to make this oath that we're about to read about. So, verse 24, and the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under an oath. Do you read that? And the men of Israel were what? Distressed that day, For Saul had placed the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until the evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. Now all the people of the land came to a forest. There was honey on the ground. And when the people had come into the woods, there was the honey dripping. But no one put his hand to the mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan, who had not heard his father charge the people with the oath, therefore he stretched out the end of the rod that was in his hand, and he dipped it in a honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance was what? It was brightened. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. But Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. Look now how my countenance is brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they have found. For now would there not have been much greater slaughter among the Philistines?" Now they had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. So the people were very faint. And the people rushed on the spoil. They took the sheep, the oxen, and the calves and slaughtered them on the ground. And the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, "Look, the people are sinning against Yahweh by eating with the blood." So he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone to me this day." Then Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep. Slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against Yahweh by eating with the blood.'" So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night and slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to Yahweh. This was the first altar that he built to Yahweh. Now Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. And let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." Then he's going to anyway. Then the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." So Saul asked counsel of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel?" But Yahweh did not answer him that day. And Saul said, "Come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. For as Yahweh lives who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not a man among all the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and my son Jonathan and I will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to Yahweh, God of Israel, "Give a perfect lot." So Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, "Cast lots between my son Jonathan and me." So Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." And Jonathan told him and said, "I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, so now I must die." Saul answered, "God, do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." But the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As Yahweh lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So, we have this oath. How foolish. You're not going to feed your troops, and you're going to run them hard? How silly is that? So he puts out this oath. Did he ask God? He doesn't ask God. He's just doing what? What did the men say? Do what seems good to you. They understood. Saul did what? What was good to him. So he is impetuous again. So it kind of does the Jephthah thing, right? Jephthah calls out to God and says, "God, if you give me this victory, I will what? I'll sacrifice you the first thing that comes out of the door of my house." What was he thinking? You know, we don't want to go there. We talked about that months ago. What's Saul thinking with this oath? So he gives this oath. Well, then we have this offense. The offense by Jonathan. What's Jonathan's offense? Just a little bit of honey. I want you to understand this. He broke an oath that he didn't even know about. Okay? He broke an oath that he didn't even know about. We'll come back to this in a moment. Okay? That's his offense. But there's a greater offense that's going on here. Did you read it? The people started eating what? Meat with the blood in it. That was a way no-no for the law. I mean, that was a cursed thing for anybody to eat meat with the blood in it, because life is in the blood. Yeah, we get it. I mean, even us today, even in Acts chapter 15, when there's the Jerusalem Council and they're in the early church and they're discerning what is it that the Gentiles need to do, well, the Gentiles don't have to follow the law except for they're not supposed to practice idolatry and they're not supposed to eat meat that's been strangled or meat that has the blood still in it. So eating the blood is still a no-no even for the church today. It's a big no-no for God, okay? So not a small little no-no, big no-no, okay? And so whose fault is it? Whose fault is it that the people are eating meat with the blood in it? Okay, how many are you going to say Saul? Come on. Okay, how many are you going to say it's the people? I knew I had a split because nobody wants to commit on this one. It's the people's fault. It's not Saul's fault. Now, Saul was wrong for what? Doing the oath, okay? He's going to give an account for that. But the people knew about the oath, and they still what? They ate. Now, it's one thing to eat, but they knew that they weren't supposed to eat meat with the blood in it. So at least if you're going to break the oath, do what? Honor God by grilling it, cooking it, doing something with it, you know? But you're eating meat with the blood in it. It's their fault. It's not Saul's fault, okay? So, I mean, but I say that because I knew exactly what was going to happen on that one, okay? But isn't that the American thing? It's not my fault. Somebody else made me do it. If they wouldn't have done this, then I wouldn't have done that. Come on, parents. Have you ever heard that? Okay. If Joey didn't do this, then I wouldn't have done that. Jane, is that true? Joey? Well, Jane did this. Oh, so I did that. I mean, and you go back. He's like, good grief, you guys. Okay. But that's how we act sometimes. So there's this offense. So the oath, the offense. Now, here's the deal. When it comes to the outcome, okay? So we come to this point where Saul now, he wants to go before the Lord and discern God's will, right? Because all this is going on. I mean, remember, when he goes to get God's will, it's right on the heels of everybody telling him that the people are eating meat with the blood in it, right? That's when he finds out and he says, bring them here. Let's sacrifice them here. Let's cook them here. Does Saul know that Jonathan has eaten honey? Does Saul know that the people have been eating meat with the blood in it? So when he calls upon God and God doesn't answer, and in his righteousness he says, you shouldn't be doing this thing. There must be sin in the camp. A good Joshua moment, isn't it? He comes and says, so let's discern what the sin is. Let's find the Achan amongst us. Even if it's Jonathan, my son, he shall die. Does he really think it's going to be Jonathan, the son? He doesn't. Another impetuous, rash moment of a lack of self-control. He's not thinking about what he's saying. Do you understand? We don't know. I mean, at this point, we don't know what God's will is at this moment. We don't know if God wanted Jonathan to die. We don't know what God would have done with Saul's oath. Do you understand? All we know is that the people were afraid of his oath. So when Saul comes and says to Yahweh, cast the perfect lot, what's he expecting? What do you think he's expecting? He's expecting the people to be caught. And then maybe split up the people to find out which people really ate with the meat with the blood in it. That's the sin, I think, that Saul is expecting for God to come down on her. And he's not expecting anything to come back at him because he's done everything what? Right in his own eyes. How surprised do you think he must have been when the lot fell to him and Jonathan? What did I do wrong this time? Yeah, I mean, this next lot is now really going to be a challenge, isn't it? Because I've already said what? That somebody's dying, even if it's Jonathan, my son. Good thing I didn't say what, even if it was me. Anyways, so cast the lot, and now the lot comes to Jonathan. Could you imagine the pain, but the pride? Notice the reaction when Jonathan is chosen, and Jonathan, and he says to John, what did you do? And he says, I had a little bit of honey. I had just a little bit of honey, and for that, I'm going to die. And Saul says what? I'm going to. You're the one who's going to die. Isn't this an amazing thing? He had taken the oath. Now, Jonathan didn't take the oath. Saul made a curse. And then Saul said that he would kill whoever. Do you get it? It had nothing to do with the people. Again, we don't know what God's will was in any of this. He didn't ask God his will. Do you see what I'm saying? He never asked God his will. He already determined what the decision would be. He just wanted to know who he was going to kill. And so I'm challenged by that. Wisdom of leadership. Asking the right questions. Seeking the right authority to give me the answers. Not imposing my opinion and my view upon God's will. One place in the Bible that I could be wrong, but it's a perfect illustration for me. Judas Iscariot dies. He hangs himself. He kills himself. So there's a void in the 12 apostles because he was the son of perdition that Christ knew. Who's the new 12th apostle to take his place? How many say Matthias? How many say Paul? Good. That's exactly right. That's who they chose. Now, here's the deal. When they chose him, when they cast lots, it was between Barnabas, I think it was the guy's name, because it wasn't the Barnabas we know. It was another. In Matthias. They don't have a third choice. Neither one. They don't ask God, do you even want us to do this? They determine it's God's will to do it. It must be God's will because there's a void. So therefore, we should what? Fill it. They don't ask God, God, show us your will, cast the perfect lots. Should we fill this seat or not? If they would have cast the lots and the answer would have come up no, then they would have said, oh, okay, we're supposed to leave it empty. God must have his own person to fill this spot. But what they say is it this one or this one? Okay, cast the lots. You know, evens, it's Matthias. Odds, it's Barnabas. Oh, it came up evens. What would have happened if the dreidel or the die or whatever at the moment came up on its point? Ooh, that's really weird. Roll it again. That was really odd. You know, that was really strange. Do it again. Isn't that how we would react? We wouldn't have thought that God would have sovereignly imposed upon that saying, dude, you got it wrong. Nobody. You know, we'd have just picked it up and said, oh, that's really weird. Roll it again. Asking the right question. Looking for the right discernment from the right authority. Do you really want God's will? This is for Bob. Or do you really want what you want? Like the people said to Saul. You're going to do what you want anyway. Just do what you want. Do you really want what God wants, or do you want what you want? Because in the end, who knows? God knows. Could God have allowed the lot to go to the people? He could have. Did they sin? And did they sin something that was worthy of death according to the law? Yes. That lot could have fallen on them very easily, but it would not have served the point that God needed to make at that moment. And that the sin ultimately lied with who? With Saul. And so, yes, don't use it as an excuse, but yes, there is that point where ultimately Saul hit the first domino. Does that make sense? The dominoes might have been set up, and you might have been the fourth domino in. And so you were hit from the back, and you hit the person. It's kind of like in a chain reaction car thing, right? You're riding along. It doesn't matter. The person behind you is going to get charged with the accident of hitting you, but you're going to what? get charged with the accident for what? Hitting a person in front of you because you were what? Traveling too close. So if the person behind you hit you, you should have been able to hit your brake and not hit the person in front of you. Okay? So you're still charged with part of that accident. But in the end, who started the dominoes falling? Saul. And that's where God brought it. And it all began because of a lack of self-control, impetuousness, and impatience. And I ask you, as I ask myself, again, as I said in the beginning, this is Bob. Bob is right there. But that ninth fruit of the Spirit, the love, the joy, the peace, the long-suffering, the kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. It's a part of the Spirit's movement within you. It's a part of you being conformed to the image of Christ. Not having impetuousness. Not having impatience. Being able to control your emotions. Being able to control your actions to glorify God. Saul started the chain of events by not willing to wait for God to move. By taking oaths that were not according to his will. By making promises that were not according to God's standards. And God brought it right back to him. We're told that his sovereignty was established. The next verse. Verse 47, so Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against all of his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he harassed them. And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered him. The sons of Saul were Jonathan, Jishui, Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these, the name of the firstborn, Merab, and the name of the younger, Michael. And we go on with those, the rest of the details. But I have to ask myself, in the end with that, the sovereignty of Saul was established that day. How great was it, though? I think he lost the respect from all of his troops. They all withstood against him. You're going to do what you're going to do, just do it. But then when it came to Jonathan, they said what? No way. That's called what? Mutiny. There was mass mutiny at that moment. Leadership is very important. Following the Lord's guide. So the Lord's perspective in the end, Jonathan was condemned, but it was really Jonathan who was then delivered in the end. How would you describe your faith? How would God describe it? Is it even the size of a mustard seed? Would you have dared to do what Jonathan did? Are you patient or impetuous? How important do you view your vows? I didn't talk a lot about that, but clearly a vow is important in the eyes of God because he still held Jonathan what? Guilty. Do you recognize the spiritual nature of the warfare in which we are engaged? And finally, is there a need to change the way you think and therefore change the way you act? Let's pray. Father, thank you for your love. Thank you for your word. Lord, it's challenging as we analyze the character flaws of other individuals that you've recorded in the Word and we see ourselves in it. Maybe not to the magnitude of those, but yet still, in your eyes, one and the same. Lord, forgive us for our lack of faith. Forgive us, Lord, for our lack of patience in waiting on your hand. Help us to be increasingly conformed to the image of Christ. Lord, help us to bring forth the spiritual fruit that you desire to have in us for your glory. In Christ's name, amen.